This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us today. We'll begin with what happened in the nation's capital. All eyes were on Washington, D.C. yesterday as a violent pro-Trump mob stormed the Capitol building. Lawmakers were forced into hiding and four people died, including a woman shot by Capitol Police. Earlier, the president urged supporters to march to Capitol Hill to protest his election defeat, which he continues to claim, without evidence, was fraudulent. And as the insurrection took hold, he did little to calm the riots. Congress eventually resumed, and overnight, lawmakers confirmed President-elect Joe Biden's victory. Trump has now agreed to a, quote, orderly transition on January 20th. But questions remain about the damage done to the country and if Trump is fit for office. I'm joined by David Preece, the chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute. He's a former CIA officer who writes about the presidency and national security. David Preece, welcome back to Lake Effect.
It's good to be with you. I wish it were under different circumstances.
I do as well. You know, last time we had you on, we talked about past contentious elections and the importance of concessions. Now, fast forward to the events of yesterday. Just start, what's going on through your mind?
Well, you know what? This morning, I, wake up to see that President Trump has issued a statement saying that there will be an orderly transition on January 20th. And that is the ray of hope that is out there. However, it is still surrounded by language about disagreeing with the outcome and insisting the facts bear him out. And even after he saw the carnage yesterday and continued to say he loved his supporters and yes, go home, but we're completely right and we were cheated and this is a fraud and essentially throwing more gasoline on an already raging fire. So for me, I don't know. I have this feeling that we'll get through this. We got through a civil war as a country, and we not only survived, but thrived from that. And I have optimism about that, but what a horrible sight that I never thought I'd have to witness in my lifetime.
Your experience in past administrations and as a security official, I really want to get into your insight here. So, it's not a surprise that this protest occurred. It was announced, that there would be protests during the finalization of votes. But what baffles me was the lack of security at the U.S. Capitol as Congress met in a joint session to carry out their jobs and a mob stormed the building. Now, you worked as a CIA officer and I imagine have some insight at least to the basics of what the Capitol security is like. So how much did this surprise you?
Yeah, I'll hit it from two angles, Audrey. First, at CIA, I analyzed situations like this in the world, in other countries, and never thought I would do so in our own country. It goes back to something that former CIA director and defense secretary Bob Gates said, and I'll paraphrase him. He said that CIA analysts are really good at understanding the politics of every country around the world, except their own. And I think generally that's true because people analyzing the kinds of things that happen in other countries less fortunate than us generally don't pay that much attention to the politics of the United States. And now suddenly that experience is useful. We're looking at insurrections. We're looking at insurgencies. We're looking at cults of personality that lead to violence against government institutions, the kinds of things that we all thought happened elsewhere. So yes, part of it is a lens turning backwards on ourselves from experience earned elsewhere. For the physical security at the Capitol, I'm still getting up to speed on all the various video feeds that are coming out. And what I'm seeing is the fact that the Capitol Police Force, which is a relatively large force covering a very small area, has a primary goal of protecting members, also of protecting facilities, but protecting the members. And it looks like when the danger started, they clearly focused on mission number one. And their personnel outside were trying to push back. I've seen some videos showing that they were trying to hold the line and were actually overwhelmed. I've seen other video that they simply weren't there, that they were getting walked right by. And that may have been because they were easily outnumbered and knew that any resistance would actually lead to immediate violence. No doubt there will be an after action report. There always is after a situation like this. I think that the inability before the event to anticipate what could happen is a tragic error that led to the loss of life. And there should have been National Guard and other authorities visibly present, even if they were there and off to the side. The one thing that it points out for, obviously, those of us who studied terrorism is how easy it actually was to breach the Capitol. And the lessons for terrorists are horrific. And hopefully any remedial steps they take will be quick and effective before anybody gets the idea that this should be a regular occurrence.
So one thing that has been commented a lot is the, you know, direct lack of security compared to what forces were brought in for BLM protests. Or, you know, even here in Wisconsin, we had more National Guard in the Kenosha, announcements compared to at the national capital. What are your thoughts on that?
Washington, D.C. is a funny place. And I mean that in every possible meaning of the term. They are used to protests. Law enforcement is used to movements, people picketing, people screaming. Most of the time, those don't turn into armed assaults on the Capitol building. So it is understandable that police did not take the kind of approach that they did in other circumstances. Why is it that different law enforcement officers, presumably none of the same ones, different law enforcement officers when facing largely nonviolent protesters, some of whom sitting down, you know, chanting for Black Lives Matter, chose to take direct action when those surrounding the Capitol building didn't? That's a tough question. And I think it goes to issues of de-escalation and police tactics overall. But I think they are, if not apples and oranges, they're at least different kinds of apples because the situation in Washington has prepared Capitol Police and other law enforcement there to emphasize First Amendment rights. This is why the situation at Lafayette Square was so disarming several months ago, because that was so out of the norm for Washington, D.C. protests, which happen virtually every day of the week somewhere in Washington, and law enforcement is used to it. The contrast, as you point out, is jarring between what happened much of last year and what happened yesterday.
So yesterday afternoon, the National Association of Manufacturers were the first to call upon Vice President Mike Pence to work with the cabinet to enact the 25th Amendment in order to remove the president, you know, quote, to preserve democracy. And here in Wisconsin, Attorney General Josh Call called for the same, and we've seen a few other people do so as well. Would this be the first time it would take the 25th Amendment to get a president out?
Yes, the 25th Amendment actually hasn't been around that long. It's only been around since the late 1960s. So we haven't had as many opportunities to use it as other elements of the Constitution. But it has never been used in the form it's being discussed now. That's because there is a Section 3 of the amendment, which the president can declare himself unable temporarily and assign power to the vice president. And two presidents have done this. Ronald Reagan did it for a surgery, and George W. Bush did it for two surgeries. And the vice president was acting president while they were under anesthesia. Section 4 is the one that we're talking about now. Section 4 is the one by which the president can be removed for disability against his will. And that does require the vice president, and that is essential. It cannot happen without the vice president agreeing to it. It also requires a majority of the executive officers of the executive departments, fancy language, which is usually shorthanded as the cabinet. Once the majority of cabinet officers and the vice president declare that the president is unable to perform the duties of the office, they pass that declaration to the leadership of Congress. And at that moment, the vice president is the acting president. It does not remove the president from power permanently. It simply says he is temporarily unable to exercise the powers and duties of the office. The president can challenge it, and there's a long, elaborate mechanism by which that can be overruled. But essentially, with 13 days left, Mike Pence would be the acting president for the rest of the term. Now, the issue is that what the 25th Amendment was designed for? Because originally, the framers had in mind a situation like a coma or a devastating stroke, or a situation like John Kennedy faced when he was shot. What if that bullet were off by a few inches, and instead of killing him, it merely disabled him, but he was not conscious and could not willingly transfer power to the vice president? That's what the 25th Amendment Section 4 is designed for. However, there is a strong case now that the president is unable, for whatever reason, to exercise the powers and duties of the office. He did not do anything in his power to quell the unrest yesterday. In fact, he incited it. But afterwards, he did not go out and try to calm it down. He did not exercise his authority as commander-in-chief to try to bring powers to bear to stop the unrest. An argument could be made in an extreme circumstance, which this is, that a 25th Amendment Section 4 application is appropriate. The big sticky wicket is the vice president. We've seen no indication from him so far that he would be willing to do this and appear like he is acting against the man that he's been so subservient to for years.
Right. So with Pence being part of the major equation in this case, would the 25th Amendment or impeachment be a more effective tool? And of course, you said there's 13 days left.
Yeah. The real issue here is impeachment and removal is the proper tool. That is, if nothing else, the president demonstrated his fundamental unfitness for office yesterday. Inciting a crowd to attack an element of the U.S. government is manifest unfitness for office. The proper remedy for that is impeachment and removal. And as part of the removal, the Senate can also disqualify the president from holding any future office of the United States. The problem is it takes time. Now, there are elaborate rules that the House and the Senate have set up for how to bring the articles and how to transmit them to the Senate and how to hold the trial. But those are all rules. Those are not constitutional mandates. And the House and Senate can easily and quickly change those rules if need be to have an expedited trial. And we did see just a year ago, the Senate did essentially massage some of its rules to make sure that the trial went the way they wanted it to, not even calling witnesses, for example. So it can be done, but to change the rules of the House and Senate, and then to go through even an expedited trial that, because of due process and principles of justice, has to allow the president some defense, that will take time, even if only a few days in a very rushed trial. What can the president do in a few days? We've seen what he could do in a few hours. One of the ideas that's out there is, why not do both? why not, in an emergency, use the 25th Amendment to remove the powers and duties from the president temporarily after demonstrating unfitness for office, but also an inability to fulfill his oath and govern? And then buy time for the House and Senate to act in an impeachment and removal process.
Perhaps we shouldn't call these periods before presidential transitions as lame duck anymore.
Yeah, it's something that, honestly, a lot of people were talking about back in November. The election happened, and then December, we knew that the president-elect was Joe Biden. And I was seeing a lot of commentary about, well, we don't have to worry now. The president has been removed. And many of us had to point out, no, the voters have spoken and the process is occurring, but the president is the president until January 20th and has the full powers and duties of the office until that time. People call it a lame duck period, mostly for political reasons, thinking it's hard to advance legislation when Congress knows you're going out the door. You don't have that momentum. But in terms of the most dangerous things the president can do, that is all there until noon on January 20th.
So what do you think yesterday's events will do to our country's reputation, not just damage among Americans, but on an international scale?
One of the most jarring things for me to see yesterday were statements from foreign countries that were written, and maybe for all I know, they were copied and pasted from, but they were written like statements that the U.S. government, the State Department in particular, used to issue about political violence in other countries. Countries wishing the American people well and condemning the violence they see in the country and urging us to return to a rule of law. Shaking my head is not enough to say what it did to me to see those. The reputation of the United States certainly has been damaged due to all the violations of norms and traditions and undermining of alliances and friendships in the last few years. But I think most people around the country still get that the United States, despite its flaws, is largely a force for good. And they emulate our system. They emulate our culture in many ways. There's a lot about America that attracts the world. That was not what we saw yesterday. What we saw yesterday was probably the world looking at America saying, and you too, this happens there. And looking for a better day for us, because I think the world does better when America does better. Look at the post-World War II situation. This is a case where America has the ability to use this as a moment to say, what do we want to be? And how do we want the world to see us? And will we live up to the expectations of people around the world who have yearned for America before? I don't want to be the silver lining guy all the time, but I gotta say, it was a very dark day yesterday. But if there's a chance for us to rediscover what it is that makes America great and show that to the world again, we can use this as a wake-up call and get back to where we should be.
David Pries is the Chief Operating Officer of the Lawfare Institute. He's also a writer and speaker on the presidency, national security, and intelligence, who served during the Bill Clinton and George W. Bush administrations as a CIA officer. You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at wuwm.com.